And our special guest tonight, Walter Burian. We're going to take phone calls with Walter and continue this discussion. Plus, soon we'll get into the TARP program, the bailout program, and what it all means as well. Walter, I want to talk about this eliminating of all taxation with some of the work you're doing in just a second. But the TARP program and the bailout program seems to me a public version of what they've been doing all these years, is it?
Well, I mentioned about the $35 trillion being sucked out of the world economy at the end of 2008. Right. When I give a definition there, that'll answer that question. As I mentioned, in 2000, the derivative market was about $80 trillion worldwide, and then they expanded it to about $600 trillion from 2008. And the majority of that expansion was through the banks, but for the primary investors, which were local and federal government investment funds. The come right around a little bit before March, it was actually August, CalPERS International had an AP press release saying they wanted to hire another 450 derivative desk traders for their international operation.
Hmm.
Now, 450 desk traders is larger than what Merrill Lynch would have.
That's huge, isn't it?
And yeah, and this was just their add-on. That was my tip-off that they were getting ready for the big slam, you know, because you had the Dow up around 14,000. Crude oil was just at 150. Precious metals were, at a high at that time. And I put out an email alert on September 15th stating, get ready for the biggest market chaos and collapse seen in the last 60 years. Have cash in hand. be prepared. Neocons at work.
Yeah,
neocons at work. What they did was, now, government outsourced a lot of their investment capital starting in the 80s, and CalPERS International actually is one good example. They funneled money from California and other local governments from all over the country to participate due to the factor that usually on the local government investment funds, they were restricted by statute where they couldn't have more than 5-10% invested outside of the country or outside of the dollar. And by participating on the international investment front, they were now not subject to those pesky little rules, basically is what was done. So, they started the marketing in the 80s and, trillions funneled offshore for management. Now, going into the end of 2008, on the international and also on some of the large domestic operations, the investment funds heavily shorted the international derivatives market for the stock indexes worldwide. They heavily shorted precious metals. They heavily shorted, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands of contracts.
And to those who don't know what that means you are betting that everything's going to go down, not up, right?
Right. A derivative is strictly a contract bet. It's always written in time, 3 months out, 6 months out, 1 year out, 2 years out, where there's a buyer and a seller, and they take a commitment on one side of the trade. If you buy, you're going long, and if you sell first, you're going short. And it's all done on paper, so you really don't have to have the physical commodity to back it up because you can always cancel out your trade on paper before it comes due at the end of that time period.
And you got to scramble.
So they heavily shorted the precious metals, heavily shorted crude oil, heavily shorted the international stock indexes, and heavily went long the dollar. The dollar index at that time was at about 71. And then what happened was they started dumping their physical holdings. Now, as I mentioned, government outsourced a long time ago. So they were well diversified in all different currencies and investments, China, Russia, Mexico, all over the world, probably on the tune of about $26 trillion on international investments. And what they did was, to perpetuate the collapse, they cashed in about $4 trillion, maybe $4.5 trillion of their international investments, which were held in other currencies, China, Chinese yuan, Mexico, Mexican peso, Russia, the ruble. And by doing so, they now were going to convert back into dollars, which meant buying dollars. So from the end of 2008, last 3 months there, The dollar index went from 71 up to 89 in a month and a half.
Jeez.
The biggest pop, straight shot, in the shortest period of time ever on the dollar index. And that was due to the fact that they were cashing in about $4.5 trillion of the international investments and converting it back into dollars. Now, during that time period, everybody from across the country is saying, the dollar is going to go throughout, down through the floor, it's going to go
right,
worthless.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm there, yay, yeah. Get a clue. Take a look what's happening. And it took its largest spike. Now, simultaneously, crude oil dropped from 145 a barrel straight down to 28.
Yeah, it plummeted.
That amazed me. I thought it would stop at about $38, $42 and went right through to 28.
Yeah, it kept
now,
going down.
About a month before it did that, I was looking at the crude oil options, and I noticed there were several hundred thousand put options at $60. And I said, sheesh. Someone was taking massive commitments, expecting it to break $60, in a very short period of time.
Right.
There was nothing in between either. I mean, very small quantities up to 140, but at $60, massive, a couple hundred thousand contracts. Well, I understood when I saw it at 28, But the precious metals also went down, into the toilet during that time. And, the U.S. Treasuries, they went long the U.S. Treasuries heavily. The U.S. 30-year bonds, the life of contract highs were up until that point, for decades, was 123.24. And it shot through from 112 up to 142, which was also, when the price goes up in the bonds, that means lower interest rates. And when you have a collapse in the markets, normally the normal trader would think, well, money's going to get tight, interest rates are going to go up. So the entire public got burnt there. The whole game for the last 30 years is schooling the minnows back and forth to one end of the pond or the other, as the sharks feast.
Yeah, exactly.
The government is the shark now. And, it's being done in cooperation with, the syndicated media on priming the public, to be reactionary in one direction or another. And they get burned every single time. But, so here's this massive collapse. And as I mentioned, government's now, selling off their physical holdings internationally, which is perpetuating it internationally. They're dumping some of their physical holdings domestically, which is causing the collapse and perpetuating the collapse here. As they sat back, making a phenomenal profit on those massive short positions.
Okay, now, while all this is going on, Walter, how do you explain the economic bubble collapse that affected people, the foreclosures, the losing jobs? What happened?
The game was perpetuated due to the fact that the interest rate swap bubble, mortgages and so forth, that was ballooning and ballooning. They were trading that back and forth internationally, dividing, subdividing, trading in, these mortgages back and forth on these derivative contracts. That there was even duplication on the same principle in many instances. But keep in mind, on a derivative contract, you can put it on for 5 minutes, 5 days, or 5 months. So as these contracts rolled over, being bought, being sold, if the institutional funds that were making the money on each transaction, whether it be for 5 days or, 5 minutes, when they close out that transaction, they have no further liability. If they're doing excellent, they're walking off with truckloads of cash, okay, because they've closed out their position. Once it's settled,
sure,
it generates the money. So as the balloon was building, the bubble was building, truckloads of cash were being walked off with from the players, creating that balloon. Then when they were ready to collapse it,
on purpose, right?
They take their positions, on the short side, and then it's like musical chairs. The music stops all of a sudden.
Grab what's left.
A few million back holders. And they hit so hard, so heavy across the board that, there were so many defaults. You can only steal so much from someone. If someone gets caught in a derivative trade and they lose $140 million and they only have $100 million, they're $40 million in default. And they did it so hard, so fast, so quickly, they created defaults worldwide, massive levels of defaults.
And that's what got Bernie Madoff, right?
No, it kind of, he couldn't play his shell game anymore of
No.
selling fictitious transactions. There was some accountability that came to play. Now, if he had been, he was dealing with the public. That's why he went on so long. If he had been burning government accounts, yeah, they would have stopped him in one tenth the time.
Right away. Yeah,
But he
exactly.
knew not to, suck in the government fund managers because he would have gotten tagged. The public, not a
That's
problem.
okay, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But so here they pull out 35 trillion, out of the world economy. And what people have to understand is on a derivative transaction, for every dollar lost in one account, a dollar is credited to another account. And here we're talking about trillions of dollars that transferred hands in a very short period of time, about a month and a half, 2 months in time, is the time period it took for that collapse. So now here's the definition of arrogance. They now come in with a trillion here and a trillion there of taxpayer revenue to shore up their own casino, which they just stole $30 trillion out from the entire world economy, causing
Amazing.
the situation in the first place.
They took the definition of OPM, other people's money, and they used it brilliantly, didn't they?
Well, I mean, they've been laughing all the way down to the bank for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And the arrogance level just keeps getting more extreme and more severe because it's so easy for them to do without consequence or accountability. Bernie Madoff, he was about 30 billion that he kind of funneled through there. But even 30 billion's pocket change when you look at what the government's dealing with. Now, there's a lot of honest and ethical people within government that are, trying to do a good job, and they're, trying to maintain doing something ethical. But what happens is when you have the power structure building from the people that are cutting the deals under the table, doing things on the sly with no accountability, they're building up their wealth base, and they become the power structure, plain and simple.
And they don't care about the other people, the ones
Yeah.
that fall by the wayside.
And they'll go in there and appoint or get, the people that are supposed to oversee this and accountability. They'll put their friends in to make sure there's no consequence to their own actions. It's the definition of letting the foxes write the rules and how many hens to eat out of the hen house.
Walter, while we continue the talk, I've got a slew of folks who want to talk with you and ask you a question or two, so let's grab a few
Let's go
while
for
we
it.
can here. Let's go to Russ in Iowa. You're up with us. Go ahead, Russ.
Well, yeah, I tell you, after listening to this dialogue, I hate to say, I'm probably going to switch questions and things. And when it comes to the commodities like you're talking about and things of that nature, I actually do a little farming on the side, and I've traded commodities fairly extensively the last 7 years. And it just seems like it's changed tremendously. And you talk about the arrogancy and things like that. When you look at like corn and soybeings and things like that, and all the funds that are trading.
The fundamentals don't mean a thing anymore, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but my question is, does it eventually come around that the actual supply and demand will eventually come into place? And in other words,
It
we
will
fictitiously.
eventually come into play, but the extreme movements outside of the fundamentals is where they steal everyone's money because everyone becomes overconfident saying it can't do this, and all of a sudden it's doing three times more than they said couldn't be done in the first place. And there goes the money out of their account balances, and they swing it back real quick in the opposite direction. You'll get whipsawed back and forth as you're played.
Right. Yeah. Obviously, I mean, the more movement in it, the more these people can make money. And I mean, kind of a sad story. I actually sold oil at I think 142, thinking it was going to go down, figuring that they were playing games on it because everyone was claiming it was going to go to well over 200. And I figured that once they made the claim it was going to go over 200, that's when it was going to go down. And I had a stop at like 149, and it hit it, and then after that, it just made a run down.
Yeah, well,
But.
keep in mind this one example. Say, for example, Israel nuked Iran tonight, and everyone said, "Oh my God, silver is going to go right through the roof." And the entire population came out and bought 400,000 silver futures contracts. One futures contract is 5,000 ounces of silver. So 400,000 contracts is a lot of silver.
A lot of silver.
Massive. Well, if the institutional government accounts then came in and sold 400,001 contracts, guess what? Price is going down. And if they keep selling, all those people that just jumped in there, they're going to be stressed out of the market, taking severe losses, and get stomped out with substantial losses.
Good point. Can the little man make money, Walter, like this?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, I've been trading for 32 years. What I look for, as your friend just mentioned there, or your caller, the cue for me when I look is, you know, they're constantly promoting to the minnows to get them schooling in one direction or another. And usually when they're saying, oh, my God, it's going through the floor, there's no stopping it, you know, that's usually close to your bottom. And when they, you know, something's going up and they're giving, like, reasonable expectations of climbs, you know, maybe varying a little bit, the second it goes to, it's going to jump like this right through the roof, and there's no real justification, that's your cue that you're getting ready for the big clip.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, yeah, it's about right 8 out of 10 times you have to adjust for, you know, yeah. My friends I've been trading with for like 30 years, you know, I've learned to ask myself one question first before I make a move.
And that is?
Where would they push it at this point if they wanted to screw everybody? And I pick that point, and that's usually where it hits.
Yeah, yeah. Up or down?
Yeah, either or, yeah.
Because
the whole game is to, drive everyone out of their positions or bait them in to overextend themselves and cut their, cut their legs off.
Let's go to Oakland, Maryland. First-time caller, Curtis, you're on.
George, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I wanted to commend Walter on his efforts here. I'm a longtime listener, clear back in the early days of Art Bell. And I've always believed in the movements that Art's talked about on the air and also you, George. And I just want to let Walter know that he's a breath of fresh air, because I was involved with a group back in the 90s that had a lot of issues with the things that Walter's covering tonight. And most of the time we were put up as conspiracy theorists, because people, it was easy to go along with the norm, which the norm was what the government was preaching.
Mm-hmm.
And today, people like Walter are opening people's eyes, and I'm really thankful for that. And one question for Walter that I have real quick, and that is, Walter, do you think there's any possibility that our money system will find its way back to the gold system, and or do you think that there's a need for that? And if not, what do you think is a good substitute?
Well, I'm going to jump back to 1963-64. When we were on the silver standard and gold, and when they got off of it due to the factor that there was not enough silver and gold to back the intrinsic value that was maintained in the United States. Keep in mind, there's little money in circulation compared to the intrinsic value of the property, wealth, and assets in the United States. So, you know, the United States was expanding, so the Federal Reserve, you know, was their brainchild.
Yep.
It was actually a brilliant idea, because what they did, you know, for their benefit, what they did now, you know, a currency is strictly a bartering tool.
Walter, let's get this break. We're going to come right back to that question and your answer about the gold standard. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. After Dark, it's a magazine that you'd love when you call 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. All kinds of great stories with After Dark. Walter's website, by the way, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now, so we make it very easy for you to go over there and take a look at some of his work, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Walter, the break got us when we were talking about whether we would ever go back to the gold standard, and you were telling us, hey, you know, we were on it once, but we ran out of gold and silver in order to back it up.
Well, I'll start off with one statement. Whenever you have massive wealth, as we do in this country, there is always the potential for massive theft. Now, going back to the Federal Reserve, it was a brilliant move on the player's part. The dollar, you know, is strictly a bartering tool. It's a piece of paper with ink on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the gold, when we're on the gold standard and silver standard, there was actually only about 5%. If that, maybe 3% of the actual commodity backing up the intrinsic value and wealth in the country. And that was a very dangerous situation. The Yeah, a country like India has more gold and silver than the United States does. Probably even a small country like Thailand may have more gold than we have. But when they went over to the fiat dollar, not backed by precious metals, the Federal Reserve was designed to maintain the value of that bartering tool. Keep in mind, back thousands of years ago, they used copper, gold, silver. They used cattle, sheep. Some tropical islands used to use seashells as bartering tools for trade, except they don't fit too well on ATMs, so I guess why they faded out. But as they increased the money in circulation, I call the dollar a zero-based currency. And the reason I call it that is for every dollar that goes out, 100% of it goes back through government, through taxation, mm-hmm. one little bit at a time until it's 100% recycled. What government did over the decades, each year, they would take 3, 4, 5%, 6%, 7%, and invest it. And each year, another 3, 4, 5, 6, 8%, invest it. So those, 4, 5, 6% added up each year to where, come the year 2000, government had taken it all over by investment. The banks, the corporations, the insurance companies. And keep in mind, when you own, say, 75, 80% of a corporation in collective totals, effectively, you can determine the policy.
That's right.
Now, no local government can own more than 5% of any one corporation. Some 7% is the standard. But what happens here is private associations now come in and network with, say, 2,000-3,000 different local governments. There's approximately right now about 184,000 separate local government entities in the United States. Every city, every county, every school district, financial enterprise operation, regular enterprise operation, they're a separate entity, each with their own investments, each with their own assets. And when you start adding up the collective totals, it becomes evidently clear as to who owns what. But these private associations now, say representing 3,000, 3,500 different local governments, those collective 5% or 4% ownerships of different companies now collectively pooled, and if those local governments are giving proxy vote rights to the private associations, now the upper management can go to the board of directors meetings representing 3,000 local governments. And by proxy and the collective ownership, they may be the primary shareholder, owning 65% of that company. Now, they can determine policy. In fact, if they wanted to, they could replace the entire board of directors by exercising those proxy votes. So when people were blaming companies for outsourcing over to India, China, Russia, Mexico, it was not really the government, it was not really the corporations want to outsource, but being that the government owned those corporations through stock ownership, collective stock ownership, they were exerting their influence to have those companies outsource, so their profits would go up. Now, as I mentioned, I put the New York State Retirement Fund up on my, I'm not picking on them, it's just a nice example of a big, comprehensive annual financial report, yeah. And the pension funds show the actual investments. As you go down through the listing of investments, you'll see the top profit makers, 200%, 300%, 400%, 500%, 600% profits. In order of the best, you have the pharmaceutical companies. You then have the financial and banking structures. You then have the oil companies, and then you have the war industry groups, top profit makers. There's a slight tad bit of conflict of interest there, he says, on all policy decisions. When you start looking at the ownership, and especially entire industries that are owned in collective totals, it starts becoming crystal clear as to why the policy that is determined is determined. It guarantees profit for their own holdings. The pharmaceutical companies, which are the number ones, here they're funneling out hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer revenue, funneling through all of the drugs to the elderly, the young, and everyone in between at exorbitant prices, being paid for with taxpayer revenue, which guarantees them a profit on their own investment holdings. The health care bill that just passed, you know, the syndicated media was honest on 2 points. They said, well, the biggest beneficiary here will be the pharmaceutical companies, and the second biggest beneficiary will be the insurance companies. The one thing they didn't mention was government owns the pharmaceutical companies by collective ownership, and they're the number one investor with the insurance companies that will now have less liability.
Go figure, right?
Yeah. As I mentioned, when you start looking at the forest, the basics, becomes crystal clear. And the public, it's never talked about, never discussed, never qualified due to the factor that it is crystal clear when you look at the basics. Now, keep in mind the Comprehensive Annual Finance Report, or Annual Financial Report for Government, is the holy grail of accounting. Okay, it's like the Bible or the Torah or the, you know, so forth for the Catholic Church and religious organizations. You know, the CAFR is their Bible. never mentioned, never a word. People are constantly hearing budget report. And that's a selective grouping of tax revenue coming in and going out, with everything else excluded. The annual financial report shows the entire picture. Now, if you were a shareholder in a public corporation, AT&T, IBM, Xerox, it's mandatory that you get the annual financial report each and every year by SEC law.
Sure.
Here, government is holding back their annual financial report and all, you know, intents and purposes. It's right there to see if you look, but they never mention, never discuss. Not a peep, not a mention, not a word. Thus, the game continues and the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on. Let's take a call. Santa Ana, California. Hank, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Hank.
Yes, good evening, George, a long-time listener. And I've sent you an email some time ago that addresses these problems we're discussing tonight, including a solution to our Social Security and Medicare problems. But that's not the discussion tonight, so we'll skip it. But one of the things that was in the email was addressing this problem of providing some sort of a financial incentive for fiscal responsibility by our president, Congress, and the Senate back there in Washington and with regard to our deficit and the debt. And another thing that we need to do, and that's what I would like to see us do, is go to the fair tax, which means that everybody would have to pay their share. We would no longer have to do a tax return every year. And now then, even the over 30 million invaders and all the politicians in Washington would have to pay their share of the tax as well.
What do you think of that one, Walter?
Well, I've looked at the fair tax and so forth. I love the expression labeled fair. But the when you impose a tax, okay, a consolidated tax, you know, number one, the... You know, the public has been, you know, spoon-fed taxation, taxation, taxation. And when they've been holding back two-thirds of their gross income and not qualifying the investment income, the enterprise income, equating it with tax income, you know, it's highly misrepresentative to push this fair tax because, you know, the structure is so inherently corrupt due to that non-disclosure and that void of comprehension that's been created within the population's mind, that, you know, when you don't need taxation at all, period, and government can operate from investment wealth, yeah, it's the word taxation is, in my mind, is it's an evil word. It's not something to be applied or used, because it's not the true alternative. That's as simple as I can put it. On the, you know, in general principle, the fair tax is a decent idea, but when you look at the underlying core of the non-disclosure taking place, it makes it irrelevant, because you cannot, you know, add on another atrocity, so to say, when you do not disclose, you know, the reality of the, you know, the core substance that you're dealing with. You know, the Jim Florio in New Jersey, when I first got into this, I found out about it back in 1990 in New Jersey. And Jim Florio, the governor, had a $2.8 billion tax increase.
Mm-hmm.
It was prepared by the prior administration, but he could have vetoed it and stopped it. And he ran on a no-new tax platform. So, you know, the proverbial hit the fan. And a group sprung up. There was two DJs, John and Ken from 101.5 FM in Trenton. They're now out in L.A., John and Ken.
Oh, yeah. Normal.
Yeah, well, they were rabble-rousing, taking calls from listeners on examples of waste and misspending in government. You know, I was listening in the first couple of days, and I heard examples, 5,000, 15,000. The highest figure I heard was 85,000. I was chuckling. Called into the show with the budget report, which is the only thing I knew about at the time. Right out the bottom line figures, they had $11 billion on budget, $6 billion off budget, total service budget $17 billion, net available, I think it was $23.4
billion. God.
And I said, come on, guys, you're missing the whole point. The state's dealing with billions of dollars. If there's fraud, waste, and misspending taking place, probably taking place on the tunes of tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions. And John and Ken challenged us to start an organization to repeal the tax increase. And 10 of us got together and incorporated a group called Hands Across New Jersey. And we had our first rally 10 days out from that with the help of John and Ken rabble-rousing around the clock. We had everybody converge from all the shore points on Trenton. We had 175,000 cars converge on Trenton.
Well, and that leads me to this question, Walter. What do we do to stop the things you've pointed out tonight?
Well, that goes into the I launched a new website called TaxRetirement.com, and the site is what it states, tax retirement, retiring taxation. Going back to what I mentioned earlier regarding using the pension fund principle to operate the government's budgetary basis, you know, that's the primary goal of that site, and to do it through initiative, one venue at a time, where we go in, do a complete audit, statistical review, prepare a prospectus, showing the phase over points where, you know, from the investment return, taxation can be phased out, and in fact, actually, if it does quite well, you can issue a dividend return back to the resident property owners. When you have property tax in any local venue, you don't own your property. You're a renter. Try not paying your property tax. They'll come in and seize your property.
They seize you. That's right. They sell the taxes off, and they get your property.
You could have a $5 million property, and you're $100,000 behind. They'll come in and take your $5 million property and sell it for 40 cents on the dollar to one of their buddies, you know. It's extortion. Keep in mind, you know, Al Capone back in the 30s, you know, he'd tell local businesses, well, if you're going to do business in my town, you're going to pay me 25%.
Going to muscle you.
And if they said, well, I'm not going to pay you 25%, he'd go, yeah, you're right. You can pay me 35%. If you don't pay me in 2 weeks, I'm going to fire bomb you out. And he did. There's not too big of a difference in what's going on.
One at a time.
In fact, if you look at organized crime from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, everything that they we're doing.
We're doing now. Government's doing now.
Government's doing now, and they've expanded it 100 times fold.
And they're getting away with it.
Yeah, because they took it over. You know, if you took all the Genoveses, Gambinos, Al Capones, Giancanas, put them all together, it'd look like a bunch of kids on the street corner selling lemonade in comparison to what government's doing.
What about the state, let's say like California, that claims it's going broke?
Yeah,
are they going broke?
I smile every time I hear Schwarzenegger saying, we're $42 billion. Behind on our budget. Keep in mind, I think there's about 14,000, 15,000 local governments in California.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the state and the local government's collective investment wealth, you're probably up to around $12 trillion in totals. Now, when they say they're $32 billion behind, in reality, it's pocket change. But you have to keep the illusion going, you know, to keep the public at bay. You know,
it's like a guy who's got a lot of money and he still borrows from his friends.
Well, ask me the number one thing that caught my eye the most on what government does with their investment funds.
Well, let's see. Where would they squander it?
No. Well, it's what they do. I noticed, you know, like how government promotes their debt constantly. We need this new bond issuance. We need this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what government does is they promote their debt at the front door. And then they come in and finance their own debt with their own investment assets through the back door. You know, they'll cut a deal with a bank, brokerage house, insurance company, or even set up their own financial enterprise operation, funnel all of their investment assets into it. Then they'll have a bond issuance and then use their own investment assets to fund their own debt.
And they let the taxpayers pay it off.
Locking in an investment for themselves for the next 20 years. A good example would be, say, for example, George called me up and he said, Walter, I have $5 million in cash. I want to hide it. I want you to start a mortgage company. I'm going to give you $5 million in cash. I'm going to buy a $5 million property out in my state. I want you to underwrite my mortgage, and I want you to charge me the highest interest rate you can get away with. So you give me $5 million in cash. I pay my $225 license fee for starting a mortgage company. You buy a $5 million property. I underwrate your mortgage. I charge you 16% interest. Now you go around to all your friends, neighbors, business associates going, oh, my God, this $5 million mortgage is killing me. I don't know if I'll survive. Oh. Well, when you forget to mention it's your $5 million and you're collecting the 16% through me, slight tad bit of misrepresentation there. Now, if you went to a local government, say, for example, you know, they're funding their own, say, $100 million in bonds through this one city, you know, through an insurance company. If you said, are you funding your own debt? They can honestly say no. But if you told them, well, if you asked them, do you have $100 million invested with finance company X, and is finance company X, you know, underwriting and funding your $100 million bond, then they'd have to say yes.
So you know,
that's the example of promoting your debt at the front door and, you know, funding it through the back door.
Where do people see your documentary on that, eliminating taxes?
I've been working on it. I'm scheduling the release for January 10th. It's going to be called The Only Game in Town, The Way Our Government Can Be. The last documentary I did in 2000, it was called The Biggest Game in Town. I released it on VHS, and there was a couple thousand copies sold all over the country and the world, and people made thousands and thousands of copies. There was probably 150,000 in circulation. Well, on December of 2008, I finally got the equipment to play the VHS, upload it to my computer, convert it, and upload it to Google. So on December 25th, I uploaded The Biggest Game in Town onto Google. Within 5 days, it had 870,000 views worldwide.
Gosh.
And went right through to the front page of Google.
Good for you, Walter. Walter's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Fascinating. We've got to stop this. They're making too much money on us. Fascinating. Next up on our floating format, as we talk about something on the paranormal side of life, don't go away.